You at the home QTH?
Really? Come on, Dick. I can hear you. I can hear you on the input, but no, that's not where I am.
Roger, Roger. Understand. Have you ever used the coupler technique, Joe?
Yes, I have. I have tried that method also. I was trying to make a measurement. This is probably mainly concerned with like a repeater where you'd have the thing completely left in its type of arrangement. Like you got nothing interrupting the line, nothing open, all your connectors and cables, just as they are in a normal repeater application type of a thing. That's mainly what I was just concerned with, trying to get an idea if I was doing it the right way or the wrong way by air injecting out your signal from another antenna.
There's nothing wrong with that technique. And so, if it's a repeater you're testing which has a omnidirectional antenna, that's an approach. I still think you can get a little more accuracy with the coupling approach. I assume that you were doing this at home. You wanted to measure the sensitivity of an antenna connected to something that can be aimed in various directions, like a Yagi. But, over-the-air technique can work, just that I think the accuracy can be a dB or two in error. And in many cases, that's good enough. I mean, if you're trying to measure 0.05 dB of microvolts of sensitivity, 0.05 microvolts of sensitivity, and you're within a dB or two of that, you know the system is working very well, as opposed to 1 microvolt, which is lots of dB less sensitive. You'd be able to detect that right away. So your technique would work. The coupler technique is a very popular way of doing it, and it is working. It's doing it under working conditions. With the real antenna connected, the only thing you're doing is this extra T-connector, a couple of inches, or a directional coupler, a couple of inches of extra line length on the main transmission line, which usually is a very minor perturbation. Therefore, the answer you get is awfully darn good. How soon will it be before you get a chance to get back to that repeater with the crazy sensitivity problem with the preamp added?
Well, I got to talk to the guy. He's, I said, you know what, for the price of a couple of devices, you buy a couple of devices, I'll get together with you sometime, bring up some equipment, measure this thing, and I'd like to see it fixed for the guy. I'd like to get it working for the guy so that it's, to put it back to where it was before. And he knows it worked good for the preamp, you know, but he didn't heed what I told him about putting a, keeping a very tight cavity in front of the preamp to try to keep that, out-of-band stuff from overloading the preamp and causing you a problem, and unfortunately something got into the thing and it blew out the preamp. I think all at the same time it must have crunched something in the first and second stages in this particular receiver, and then that probably has become permanent if the preamp got replaced. But I'll get back to this guy this week and see, you know, if he's, when he wants to do this, and I'll definitely take some notations on it to try to find out what stage it was giving with grief on it. Okay. That's it. That's all I really had to say about the particular subject on the overload thing there. The overload, not the overload, the sensitivity problem. And as far as my measurement problem, I'm definitely going to look this guy up and see what he's got to say more about this. I'd like to find out some more information just to see if, you know, there's any other comments on it one way or the other. That's it. You can turn over the next guy over and listening. WHYY, KTRW.
When he suffered the damage that he did suffer, was it late summer of 2005? The reason I'm asking that is there was a really wicked storm summer of 2005, I think it was around September, where tremendous amounts of equipment on Long Island got damaged at a whole lot of different sites. Even I suffered a little bit of damage on that one. Having completely recovered from it, from all the damage that one occurred. Any idea when he suffered the damage? Was it possibly around that time frame, Joe?
No, it wasn't. It was actually after that. Someone was around in the 2006 calendar year. He had a problem for a while where he had cable leakage. And I'm not sure if it was contributed to his problem or what happened. He didn't have a circulator in the repeater, and he did not have any kind of narrow pass cavity in front of the preamp, just the duplex itself. And I told him, I said, those things, when they're tuned up properly, at best, may only give you 20-25 dB out-of-band rejection across the whole entire spectrum. And it'll, of course, pass your receive frequency and reject severely your transmit frequency. But you go anywhere else, looking plus or minus from the receive frequency, they really don't have a lot of attenuation. It's a bad thing to have happen because you really subject yourself to something out of band or something happening at high level, getting into your system there, and either whacking your preamp or something like that. He had a problem. He had a neighbor with a cable leak, and everyone, this problem used to come and go. And I'm not sure if it caused a mix when his transmitter came on, if it caused some sort of mix. But he'd get something that would hit him on the input. One day, something hit him really hard, but the S meter went up. It pinned the S meter. It was just noise. And after that effect happened, he lost the preamp and he lost his problem was created in his repeater.
Was that particular location one where it's the highest object around and therefore a sustained high voltage from Mother Nature could have come by?
Well, he didn't really have the antenna for probably, maybe on a 40-foot mast, 40-foot mast alongside the house, so it wasn't like one of these really high repeater locations. I think it was more or less in a residential area, so I don't think I don't really think it was like a static dissipation from nearby here or something like that. I think something else happened, some sort of mix happened, and it just happened to create a high enough level signal where it damaged his preamp, because it took it out at least once, and I think he had the preamp taken out, he replaced it with another one, or bought another one, that one got snuffed also. Says, you gotta just stop, go back, take a few steps back and think what you're doing here, because you can't keep on putting preamps in, you got something that's causing you some sort of problem here. So now you just start to take a little time to listen to me a little bit. And he hasn't bought out a preamp since, but the preamp doesn't do any good right now, so he hasn't had it in the circuit either. So. But within a week or two, maybe I should be possibly able to get at this thing and come up with some answers. I'm sure he'd be interested to find out what state is giving him the grief.
One of the very respected sets of preamps is made by Angle Linear, www.angleliner.com, Chip Angle, his company out in California. It makes a very nicely shielded, packaged preamplifier. And whenever you use his preamplifiers, he almost always insists you use one or two of his cavity filters in front of it. Without a filter in front of the preamp, because as you adjust the preamp for really low noise figure, you got very tight coupling on the input network, which automatically forces it to be extremely broadband. And when it's broadband, boy, something... 100 megacycles away can really bomb you. So without one of these canned filters that simultaneously gives you lightning protection and only filters your particular set of frequencies of interest, and the filter itself may have a couple of tenths of a dB insertion loss, and of course people who are looking for the ultimate in sensitivity fight that, and they think they'd rather not do it. Well, you have as much security as a long-tail cat in a room full of rocking chairs if you don't have a damn good filter in front of that preamp. So there's very little getting away with that. I wonder if you've ever seen those Angle Linear preamps. They look like an awful nice product. The top cover on the thing, I'm looking at one right now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 10 screws hold the top cover down. These are 10 countersunk screws around the perimeter of a top cover that is 2 inches wide and 1 1/4 inches wide and 2 1/2 inches long, maybe 2.5 inches long. So with that many tight screws and a real well-made cover, you get an awful lot better shielding than some other brands, in my opinion. Back to you, Joe, KQRIW.
No, I'm not that... I've heard of the name, but I've never really looked it up to find out what kind of specs that preamp has compared to the A2R. A2R's been around for quite a while. I guess this other guy's not too bad as far as what he does either. I know some of the nets I listen to on IRLP on the West Coast, this one net, there's a bunch of repeaters in the wind system that tied together. The guy who runs Chief Bottle Washer over there has had quite a few of the preamps on his repeaters, and he swears by them. He thinks they're pretty good compared to the A2R preamps.
Yeah, Chip Angle, I think, has been in the business for around 20 years, maybe a little bit less than AR², Advanced Receiver Resquared. Some people call it AR², and... West Coast people, of course, like using West Coast vendors. There are some people who think that although the preamp made by Advanced Receiver Research, beautiful product when you're testing it on a bench, great characteristics, but because of the way the covers, the upper cover and the lower cover are held on, there are people who think that it's not quite as well shielded as it should be for a repeater service, so that you'd have to do other shielding things, like build another box around it, if you really want it to be robust enough for repeater service. In repeater service, you're looking for a power spread of numbers like 170 dB, the difference between ultimate sensitivity and real power output of the transmitter. Tremendous numbers of dBs. Well, that number of dB of shielding requires a lot of extra care in the way you put on the input and output connector, the way you bypass the B-plus input, and the way you hold down the covers, the number of screws on the covers, and whether or not there's a gasketing between the two, RF gasketing, and so on. So the West Coast people really like this guy, Chip Engel Linear. When you were talking about the West Coast repeaters, is that one of the brand names, or they were saying good things, Joe?
Yeah, this guy Shorty, who runs that repeater system, has talked about them a few times. He said he's got them on a few hundred repeaters out there. He likes the performance of how they work. And I think he's also mentioned the same thing on most of his repeaters. He is using some sort of extra cavity in front of the preamp just to help it out, because some locations he's on, he's up near some pretty high density comp sites.
Yeah, what really happens that a lot of people don't quite understand with a repeater, particularly with a good preamp, is that if a strong signal comes on the air, it could be 50 megacycles away. And the filtering and the front end of the repeater itself, the receiver, probably would just laugh at that. But because the preamplifier, without a cavity filter in front of it, is so extremely broadband, it will see that signal 50 megs away. And there is a slim chance that the same 50 megs is strong enough to send the preamplifier into limiting. And it may only go 1 or 2 dB into limiting. And so if it's got 20 dB of gain, you've got 18 dB of gain left on your frequency. By the way, one of the crazy characteristics of a preamplifier is that if it goes into limiting by 1 dB on any particular frequency, with a very small variation, it's in exactly 1 dB of limiting on every frequency. So when it's in 1 dB of limiting at your favorite frequency, and you're down from 20 dB to 18 dB of gain, good common sense would say, well, it makes you work like a charm. There's a catch. And the catch is, if it's in limiting at all, it has been shoved into an area of nonlinearity. And now, along with its amplification, 18 dB or 19 dB left, you think everything's hunky-dory, it is mixing all frequencies together in all possible combinations. So now the third harmonic of one signal and the second harmonic of another, because of the mixing action that the preamplifier will create, if it has the smallest degree of nonlinearity due to limiting, it will give you all possible mixed combinations. And if that mixed combination falls on your input frequency, image, reel, or whatever, you're going to have grief. So unless you've got some kind of a sampling port on the system with a spectrum analyzer, and you're looking 100 megacycles in each direction from your frequency where you could see strong signals coming through, unless you were monitoring like that, you would never know what happened, other than the fact that you're getting these hits from time to time. And about the only protection from that is some darn good filtering up front. And it takes real volume to do it. The Chip Engel Linear, cavity filter, the 432 make version of it, is I think a 4-inch diameter copper pipe, about 6 inches long, made as a reentrant filter. The 2-meter version probably is a great big moose. It takes volume to get the cue of the filter, to get enough filtering, to make sure that only your particular frequency comes through with low insertion loss, and you're trying to create a brick wall filter with everything else being shut down lots and lots of dBs. To me, 2RYY, K2RYW.
I understand this. I do understand these preamps. They will definitely lend themselves to the overload very easily, especially up on UHF, but those preamps are at least 40 meg wide without any problem at all. It's something way, way out of bank equation, a lot of grief. And that's why it's important to know what's coming down your end, through your duplex port. If you're on a high-density comp site, you got to look about 100, 200 megs either way just to see what else is out there. And sometimes you'll be amazed how strong some of the signals are. In this particular case, the guy up in 20, which he was amazed when I took my HP analyzer, put up his receiver port of the duplex, and says, okay, now I'm going to put something on a 50 meg scan, from plus or minus 25 megs or so from your input frequency, and we'll see what kind of strong stuff is out there. He was amazed to see how strong channel 13 was coming in down his antenna and through his duplexer, and he's like 20-something miles from Midtown Manhattan. I said, see? this guy's way down at 216 megahertz, but he's giving you all sorts of grief because of the high level coming in. And your duplex is not rejecting that because the duplexer can't possibly have that kind of cue to reject that kind of signal out of far out of band. So he was amazed at that. I have since taken a 2 meter pass cavity and modified it mechanically so it works about pretty good on 220. Gives him a fairly tight window of maybe 300-400 kilohertz bandwidth, and not too much more than that. And it's got about 20-25 dB reject, as far as on its transmit frequency. So he's got a fairly narrow bandwidth, say like say from 1.6 meg, it was like 25 dB down. And that's all I can really get out of the cavity. It'd be nice to have something a little sharper, but that's, this is a lot better than what you had before. And it certainly helped in the situation, keeping all the out of band extraneous stuff down to a very, very low level.
Yeah, television broadcast station, even 20 miles away, because it runs 50,000 watts of power into the antenna, plus antenna gain, you can come up with some fierce numbers. A UHF television channel, a number of them run 3.5 million watts up to 5 million watts of effective isotropic radiated power. In other words, the antenna could act like it's got 0 dB of gain, and the signal you get a mile or 20 miles away as if he was really running 5 million watts of output, even though he's really only 50 kilowatts out of the Klystron. And so that comes roaring into your front end, and my goodness, can that do grief. I'm only 4 miles from channel 21, which I think runs something like 3.7 million watts. And I'm almost at the threshold where the signal coming down my antenna, I could rectify it, and I think I could light neon bulbs. I may be able to do some minor battery charging with it. I get an awful lot of steam on 432, even though they run 570 megs or something like that. So nearby UHF television broadcast is a real killer. I was working on some airborne electronic systems 10 or so years ago for both domestic use and Western European use, and the UHF television broadcast stations in both locations can give you an amount of steam that can really give you grief. That's the most potent thing around, other than the peak envelope power out of a radar. Some radars run 50 megawatts of peak envelope power out of the antenna. But other than the peaks of a radar, when it comes to pure, steady, high power, it can't beat a UHF station. Back to you, Rich. KQLIW. Joe.
You never will remember that name, will you? Okay, very good. All right. You can pass along to the next. I just listened and listened out. It's fascinating, but you can pass along to the next guy that was on the list of people to get to. K2RAW, WA2RYY.
You're the last guy. We could spend some time with you. The last guy who signed up. I wonder if Paul is around. We'd probably put him to sleep by now. WS2N, are you around, Paul? No, we're not going to get a space report tonight. Okay, let's see what Mel's doing. How many emails this week, Mel? And what's the top of those emails? K2KEY, K2AIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, well, I've got some nice emails, very, very nice ones, thanking us very much for repeating some of the past Smith chart tutelages. And I did get, one question here. About polar coordinates and a remark that I made about, I have a synopsis of what I said. Oh, yes, I said that polar is coordinates or polar system of net impedance, scalar, magnitude impedance, phase angle, all associated with polar notation or polar form. Is very handy when especially we have a circuit that we have inductance and resistance. And they wanted, this one person asked me if I could go a little bit, again, explain a little bit in depth what I meant by that, Dick, over.
I think you should. I am finding from last week, both Howie, you, and probably other guys, when it comes to studying complex circuits, you guys cut your teeth and learned in the polar manner. I was introduced to polar, introduced to rectangular, and for whatever reason, rectangular stuck with me. Apparently, I'm in the minority. The majority of people find it easier to understand than polar. Both work, as long as you dot the I's and cross the T's. Follow all the individual rules. Both can work like a charm. What I'm also tempted to do tonight is to mail you a copy of a check, a check on a bank that a man in Dallas mailed to a company that he got angry at. And he put the number of dollars he wants to pay them in polar form, in complex mathematics. He was so angry, he said some very angry words on the check, and he also put the number of dollars in polar form, in complex mathematics. And so the bottom line of the joke was, don't get an angry, and don't get an engineer angry. It can come back at you in some pretty highfalutin manner. Go ahead, Paul. Mel, K2KUI, K2IIW.
Yeah, well, that's cute. Yeah, it's like the guy that paid a bill that he was mad, so he walked in with stacks of pennies. And, a simple demonstration of really polar notation, of polar form. I'll give you a simple circuit, basically. I have a couple of people that I said listen, and I will, of course, it's easier for me to do it this way than trying to do it individually. I sitting with a computer and trying to do it with a keyboard, these things, Dick, it's just not my cup of tea, to say the least. So, okay, everybody has a pencil and paper ready. I'll do a very simple example. For instance, if we had a 200-ohm resistor, non-inductive resistor, carbon resistor, and we have put that in series with an inductor and also a capacitor. All right, what would be the resultant? Now, the question would be, what is the resultant Z, the impedance of this circuit, and what is its angular vector? So, in polar form, this is not a sounds like a complicated thing, but it is. So, if we have this 200-ohm resistor, okay, and we could just put it in a simple form, 200-ohm resistor plus J, and the reactance here, the conductive reactance, let's say, is 100 ohms, and our capacitive reactance, let's say, is 300 ohms, all right? I'll give it, make it easy numbers. So we would have 200 plus J bracket 100 minus 300, because the capacitive reactance would be minus, because it's capacitive, minus 300. So we do this little example, we'll come out with 200 minus J 200. And simple mathematical procedure here. Now if we take the formula Z equals square root of R squared, the resistance squared, plus the reactance X squared, and we do this, we'll come out with, 200 squared, be 40,000, plus minus 200, because we have the capacitance is larger than the inductance in resistance, so we go with the sign of the higher one, so it comes out to minus 200. So we multiply, square that, we change the sign, of course, it's going to come minus times minus, so we're going to have 40,000. So we have the square root of 40,000 plus 40,000. Now, if we take the square root then of the two added together, would be 80,000. We'll come out with 282.8 ohms. We'll leave that at that. If there's any other questions right now, I don't think so, but I'll continue in a second. Okay, now, if we want to know the angle now, we have this now, very easy. We can just take the very simple of X over R, which is minus 200 over 200, tangent of it, tangent of minus 1 of minus 200 over 200, and that'll equal the tangent of minus 1 minus 1, and that's out to minus 45 degrees. So you see, in polar form, how easy we solve this problem of Z equals 282 0.8 ohms with an angle of minus 45 degrees. I don't know if I can make it any simpler than that, Dick. Over.
You got it. And what's really going on is that you calculate angle by dividing reactance by resistance. You take the reactive component, in your case, minus 200. That's in the numerator. The resistance is 200 ohms. That's in the denominator. Divide the two together. You get just out. You get minus 1. The inverse tangent of minus 1 is minus 45 degrees. Most handheld calculators will let you do that. And so, like you said, the total impedance, 282 and a fraction ohms at an angle of minus 45. That is the phase angle of the signal reflected back from that network. In other words, if that network was in a black box and had nothing on the front of the black box but a coax connector, you connect it up to a real good network analyzer or an impedance measuring device of some kind, you would find out that it acts like a total impedance of 282 ohms, and the signal coming back to you would be minus 45 degrees of phase angle. That's a fancy way of saying the reflected signal would come back to you leading in phase by 45. That's what the minus 45 is doing. It's almost an anticipatory circuit. It's giving you a phase that's advanced from what you give it as a reflected signal. Back to you, Mel. KQKEY, KQIIW.
That's what I say. Now, polar form, I think that's the simplest way to go in a circuit like this where you have R, L, and C. Unless you think there's a better way of doing it, Dick, over.
In this particular case, Mel, if you were solving this in rectangular, it would be an extremely similar process. That is to say, in rectangular form, where you're trying to make, if you put it in the format that the Hewlett-Packard set of calculators would take, open parentheses tells you you're starting a complex number. The 200 would be the first, comma, and then the second number is the J number, but you don't have to put in the J. The machine automatically knows that. And the resultant J would be the plus 100, minus 300. And so in rectangular form, this problem would look the same. In my particular calculator, once you've got that answer of 200 minus J200, open and close parentheses accordingly, you can then press the key that's called absolute value, and it would give you the 282 ohms. You press another key called rectangular to polar conversion, and it would tell you, again, magnitude 282, and it would tell you minus 45 degrees. Even in rectangular form, people measure phase angle by inverse tangent of reactive component over the resistive component. So there's a strong similarity with your particular problem, rectangular and polar. Life gets a little bit more complicated if the R, L, and C are in parallel with each other in some kind of a combination. And there, I think the majority of people would prefer the polar approach, but in either case, it gets a little more complicated. But once a person understands the principles, there's a lot to be gained by this, in understanding of how these networks are working. All of our receivers and transmitters are using PI networks and L networks and whatever, and to be able to analyze various combinations of these and be able to predict what's going to happen even before you wind the coil, even before you solder down the capacitor, to be able to predict on paper what's going to happen ahead of time, a certain kind of an engineer gets a lot of pleasure out of that. It makes him feel that all's right with the world, he understands it, and not quite as much mystery as there. There's always mystery when it comes to RF. Guarantee it. K2KEY, K2IIW on the TechNet.
Hey, Waste.
Yeah, I figured that this is K2KEY. Well, like I say, I try to break it down to the simplest methods that I can possibly, you know, explain in this case. Another question I got, and again, here we go with the math again. This young fellow, in fact, called me on the phone, and he tells me his problem. He had an old calibrator with a tube in it, tube calibrator, 100 kilohertz calibrator. And some way, another, there's a small coil, he says, choke-like device or whatever, that goes to the tube, and it got destroyed. It got broken up. So he asked me, he says, how would I go about determining the approximate value of that little device? So I said to him, well, he gave me some particulars, like he told me there was a 0.1 capacitor across it, and some particulars like that. So I gave him a formula that would give him the approximate value of that little inductor. I gave him a formula, L equals 25330 over the square root, L equals 25330 divided by F squared times C. And he says, well, he worked it out and all, and it came out like 250 microhenry was the coil, little coil in there. And he says, gee, he says, I haven't seen this. I looked at my books and I told my teacher and all, and he said, you know, it's not in the books. Where did you get this from? I says, well, so I tried to explain. It's actually derived originally from F equals 1 over 2 pi times the square root of LC. But that formula is working, that frequency is basically in that formula in cycles, or it hertz, inductance is in basically in henries, and the capacitance is basically in farads. So I said, being that you're working in a type of radio device, I would assume that you'd like to be, you know, work in things like megahertz and kilohertz. So by using this formula I just gave you, the frequency is in megahertz, just watch your decimal point. Your inductance is going to be in microhenries, and your capacitance is going to be in what we used to call MMF. I got it written down, but of course it's now picofarad. And for some reason, he said they couldn't find it in any of the electronics math books, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm checking on it right now. Let's see now. Whoops, did I do that correctly? 1 over. Okay, I made a mistake. I can see what you've done, and that is the original equation, F equals 1 over 2 pi square root of LC, which is one of the formulas we used to have to memorize in order to pass any of the FCC tests. If you square both sides, you get F squared equals 1 over 2 pi squared LC. And then you can easily move L to the left and leave everything else there, and you get the formula that you've gotten, and then also make the units conversions, microhenries, millihenries, picofarads, and so on. To be able to take any of the formulas we memorize and be able to solve it for another one of the variables, in this case you solve it for L instead of for F, that is an ability that is very valuable. People who haven't studied algebra for a while have a little bit of trouble with it at first. But when it comes to the equations for area of an antenna, gain of an antenna, and wavelength and whatever, that particular formula, to be able to manipulate it, so you solve for the area, or solve for the wavelength, or solve for the gain, another extremely handy formula, and to be able to move things around, so to speak, is a darn good thing to know. And you're sort of teaching that now, and I think you should continue. K2KEY, K2IOW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, I gave him three formulas, and he says his teacher was very impressed. He wants to know what book I took this out of. I don't know what's going on, really. is all my math ancient math? Or like one guy once said when I was working, he says, one day he says, you'll take out a stone tablet and show us where it was all, how you chiseled it originally into a stone tablet. I said, well, when I worked with Archimedes, you know, that's how he did it. Anyhow, I gave him three formulas. One was F squared equals, I said, write it down now, and that's why repeating it because his friends are listening. I want to thank them all also for listening, and I also want to thank all the nice emails that I got. I got a lot of real nice emails. Again, the ones that I got that asking me or some of the brochures here to give them any information or ideas about some of these products, no, I'm just not going to make a comment on any of that. But the three formulas I did give them was F squared equals 25330 divided by L times C. That's for frequency. Then I gave them the one I just mentioned, L equals 25330 divided by F squared, a frequency squared, times C. And the third one is C equals 25330 divided by F squared times L. So that'll give you the three different, whether which one you want to, you know, find. If you want to find the frequency, the inductance, or the capacitance. In other words, it gives you a ballpark figure to replace that component. If, for instance, if you know, you know, any two of the parameters in there, you can, you know, easily solve it. In his case, he knew the frequency, and he knew the capacitance in there, and so I he was able to solve the L to give him the little inductor, and because he put it in, worked perfect. So what should I say? But it's funny that these, to me, are very simple. I guess they simplified a lot of things years ago because we didn't have the calculators and, you know, did most of our work with the slide rules or paper and pencil. So what happened? Did these formula things just go with the Indians, as they say, or with the old-timers, or with us, you know, over-the-hill bunch, Dick, over?
I can see two possible ways that it came about, Mel. One is a smart person took that basic formula, F equals 1 over 2 pi, square root of LC, and by squaring both sides and then deciding which one he's going to solve for it. By the way, the whole reason you square both sides is to get rid of the square root. You've got to be a little bit careful. Occasionally when you square both sides, you'll create a couple of extra roots that may not be real. But to get rid of the square root makes things very simple, and then you can solve for F, solve for L, or solve for C. That's one way it could have come about. The other way is, my impression is Brooklyn Technical High School taught people very practical knowledge that you can apply directly. Engineering, useful knowledge. I'm seeing it time and time again. The guys who went to Brooklyn Tech really have a gut feel how things work. They memorize a couple of fairly simple formulas and apply them. In the work that I do with antennas, you'd be amazed how many people have four or five formulas they use almost every day, rules of thumb. One of them predicts the beamwidth of a antenna once you know the dimensions of it, like if it was a horn. Somebody tells you the horn is 3 inches wide and 2 inches high at the mouth of the horn, and it's being used at the 3-centimeter band, and they can predict for you exactly what the beamwidth is going to be and what the gain is going to be. There's a couple of very simple formulas that people use. I had the impression that Brooklyn Tech taught an awful lot of those. I bet you that's where some of it's coming from. I know you also went to Ohio University, and they're a little bit deeper into theory. But I think you had some association with Krauss, and he also, being a ham background guy, even though he published some darn good books, had some very practical formulas he would use day to day. So I'll bet you 75% of what you're preaching to us, Mel, came from Brooklyn Tech, and the other 25% came from Ohio University. What do you think? Or maybe some of it was Army training, K2LIW.
Yeah, I guess a little of each, Dick. This is K2KEY. No, I was just saying that this math, you know, is still viable today. That's all, really, you know, because I don't, it's not taught. That's it. Why, I don't know. What's the reasoning that things like this have just died away? And I've got a lot of these formulas, and I was questioned that, you mean to tell me you've got a lot of this math? I said, oh yeah, I've got quite a bit of different methods that seem to be sort of off. They stay in a tangent from what is taught today. But I always thought that, you know, keeping it simple. When you're out there in the field, field and you have to solve a problem and all, the simpler the way you can solve it, the better. And like I say, we didn't have, you know, too much sophistication to work with. So things that easily you can remember in your mind, you know, to come up with in a pinch, come up with some little inductor that you had can stick in the circuit, make the thing work again real quick without, you know, getting into all kinds of paperwork, pencil work and everything. That's the only thing. So I really am very surprised that these things are just these, so many of these formulas and things that have been simplified and formed by the wayside. I just have no answer for it, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I think the old days, we got to be careful that we don't sound like old fogies. We're talking about the good old days. But teaching methods have definitely changed. Reminds me a little bit of what it was like listening to George Burns when he used to be interviewed. George Burns, who lived to 101 years of age, but around 97 years of age, when he was still pretty chipper, and somebody would interview him, like Merv Griffin, and he would tell you the songs that were popular in his youth. And he would sing these ditties, very simple-sounding, very good philosophy-type songs, and you suddenly realize, gee, that's a nice piece of music. I've never heard that before. Okay, hey, George, you came up with a wild one. Well, you sit and watch George Burns being interviewed 7 times in a row. You hear 15 different songs, and you suddenly realize, I never heard any of those songs. Where the hell is this stuff coming from? Well, that was popular in his youth a whole lot of years ago, and for whatever reason, some of that didn't get carried forward. There wasn't tape recorders, there wasn't DVDs, there wasn't television, and for the most part, there wasn't radio. There was nothing to carry those songs forward, and they sort of died as far as modern stuff is concerned. On top of that, styles change. What we like for songs nowadays have changed. Well, by the same token, teaching methods have changed. You take a guy who went to school 40 years ago, he went under a pretty different system than we got today. There were some advantages in what you got today, there were some disadvantages. I mean, one of the things you and I went through, Mel, no matter which school you went to, they taught you how to cast off by twos in order to, by long division, find square roots. We don't teach that nowadays because every $5 calculator or $2 calculator has a square root key. You press the key and there comes the square root to the nearest 10 decimal places. Good enough. Fast. You don't have to teach that. You can spend the time better teaching other things nowadays, like maybe how to keep your wife happy or whatever. And as such, teaching continuously changes. But in some cases, we lose a little something and you gain something as things change. Math, for whatever reason, seems to be de-emphasized. I got 2 or 3 guesses as to why. An awful lot of people don't like it. They get mad. Second of all, a hell of a...